Denise Kiernan, welcome to Like Effect. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So your latest book is The Last Castle, all about the Biltmore Estate, which remains to be the largest house on U.S. soil. But to start, what first brought your attention to the Biltmore Estate?
It's a fairly convoluted answer. So the first time I went, I was actually 14 years old. My dad was stationed in South Carolina. My mom said, let's go see this historic house for the weekend. Most 14-year-olds would roll their eyes at that, but I was a little history nerd. So I heard that and I was like, yes, let's go see a historic house. When I was 14, Biltmore was quite different and a little more mellow, but still, I mean, stunning. And I felt like I was stepping back in time when I walked into the house. So many of the family's furnishings are there, tapestries, all these sorts of things. It was really, really immersive. But I never thought I'd be back in Asheville again. Cut to 12 years ago, and I'm living in Asheville. And one of the first things I decide to do is go to Biltmore House with my Jersey husband, who didn't even know what Biltmore House was, and I hadn't been in ages. And the two of us went together, and now as an adult who writes, I became really curious, not just about, you know, the house and its size, but who had lived there, who had made this place what it was, and how did it still possibly manage to exist?
Right. And there's a lot of history with this house, not just with its original owner, conceptualizer, but his family history, his wife's family history. And it's a lot of primary documents, I imagine. So what kind of research did you rummage through, and how difficult was it for you to kind of make a blueprint for this book?
Well, I write all sorts of stuff. I started out in journalism. I enjoy screenwriting. I enjoy fiction, but narrative nonfiction is my thing. And I could just stay locked in archives for hours and be happy as a clam. For this particular book, I consulted many, many different archives. And for anybody who's curious at looking at that sort of stuff themselves, you can find them all in the back of the book. Two of my most significant troves were, first, the New York Public Library Manuscript and Archives Division. That had the papers of William B. Osgood Field, one of George's best friends, and Paul Lester Ford, noted and often unknown novelist, Paul Lester Ford, whose life was sadly cut short, also a very dear friend of George. Their family members as well had papers there. That provided Field's diaries alone for he and George's travels before George got married to Edith. And as George was beginning his engagement to Edith, that was spectacular. And, you know, of course, when somebody writes someone a letter, their thoughts and feelings, their letters are often in that person's archives. So there were just the most wonderful, affectionate letters from George to Field and to Ford and to Ford's relatives on different occasions, whether it be, you know, the birth of the daughter or marriage, all of these sorts of wonderful things. Then at the Hay Library archives at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island, Edith's sister, Natalie, who married John Brown, the Brown family, extremely established in Rhode Island, her papers are there, as well as her husband's and her son's. And that had a tremendous amount of family information about Edith, including when they were all just young, unmarried women. Edith was one of the main inspirations for wanting to do this book, and that for me was spectacular. I mean, I actually start the book with Edith Stuyvesant Dresser, who went on to be Edith Vanderbilt, married to George and mistress of Biltmore House. I wanted to show her as an independent woman, as a single woman, as a young woman, before she simply became a married woman, you know, married to Mrs. George Vanderbilt. And being able to sort of really get a feeling for who she was made a huge, huge difference for me. And then in addition to those, it was, you know, Library of Congress, the Wellcome University in the United Kingdom, the Beinecke at Yale, stuff all over the place. But those two and the Library of Congress brought a lot of world building to the book for me.
I do want to get back to Edith soon, but before we touch upon that, I want to talk about the Gilded Age. You know, it's post-Civil War, not quite industrialization. America's kind of in this limbo transitional period, and you definitely have the haves and the have-nots. And, of course, George Vanderbilt came upon his money through his family, his grandfather, their businesses. And, you know, in the book, there's a quote, "The rich sought to conquer one another on battlefields of architectural grandeur." So what do you think set George Vanderbilt apart from his fellow American aristocrats?
Yeah, so when you think about what brought George to the Asheville area of North Carolina, I think there are a lot of things that go into it. So he's the grandson of the Commodore, Cornelius Vanderbilt, the founder of the family fortune. George's father, William Henry, doubled his inheritance and was considered at the time to be possibly the richest man in the world. George was William Henry's youngest child. George's older brothers were all interested in going into the shipping and railroad business. George was not. Like you said, he wanted to read his books. He wanted to go to concerts. He wanted to listen to music. He wanted to travel, collect art, be a patron of the arts. He had a passion for these pursuits and had the time and the money to indulge them to his heart's content. And, you know, at that time, if you were going to have a retreat, you were likely going to have it, have a quote-unquote cottage in Newport, a 60,000 square foot cottage in Newport, or perhaps something in the Berkshires. You know, you would probably travel to Paris regularly, which George did. But he was down in North Carolina traveling with his mother. And that was actually not that unusual back then because people thought, you know, this is the Blue Ridge Mountains, Smoky Mountains. People thought that the mountain air was curative. So if you suffered from symptoms related to malaria or tuberculosis, you could sit on what they called breathing porches and breathe. And this lovely little cottage industry springs up down there. So George brought his mom down there. She was being treated by a doctor. And while she was breathing on a porch, he went out on his horse and saw some really beautiful land and then thought, no, this is where I'm going to do what I'm going to do. And so when you talk about that kind of waging battles on marble floors or whatever that author would have said. so many of these people obviously did not have to work, had amounts of money that was difficult to fathom. And, you know, one thing that they did was they spent their money on these incredible architectural endeavors. You know, in a certain respect, there's so much excess, but, you know, they became these tremendous patrons of the arts. I mean, you know, we have countless paintings. You know, John Singer Sargent had a wonderful career and we got to see his talents. A lot of that is because of the support of some of these people. Whistler as well, so many sculptors, etc. And George just wanted to do something a little different. And I think that because he seemed like such a quiet, private, bookish individual, I imagine that the society in New York could be so claustrophobic and so incestuous. You know, we talk about the 1% today. They talked about the 400 back then, mm-hmm. You know, the number of people who could fit into Carolyn Astor's ballroom. And that just wasn't George's scene. So I think he saw a real opportunity to indulge his love of architecture, art, and kind of, you know, get away from it all.
Well, I think that's evident in some of the design aspects, such as like the acorns and oak leaves that are the sort of Vanderbilt symbol on this massive house versus, I'm sure, other families have crests and everything.
Sure, they had to make theirs up, yeah.
Yeah, so that kind of is a testament to his personality.
Well, they, you know, it's sometimes easy for us to forget that the Vanderbilts were actually considered very new money back then. And in fact, the Commodore, George's grandfather, you know, some people just found him terribly crass and boorish. And so they weren't necessarily
old American families.
Yeah, exactly. And so, yeah, they didn't have those crests that had been in the family forever.
Yeah, on the note of those little details, are there any favorite parts or aspects of the estate that stay in your brain? I mean, you're overwhelmed by so much when you visit
you
this
are.
Place.
I think one of the most magical parts of the estate is its setting, really, is the landscape architecture. Thanks to the father of landscape architecture, Frederick Law Olmsted, he painstakingly mapped out what they call the approach road, which is the road that a carriage would have traveled on to get from the front gates of the estate actually up to Biltmore House. And it is, you know, it is winding and almost kind of, you know, just embraces you as you wander through. And you don't really see the house until the final, you know, the final turn. And you have this big final reveal. And then facing the house, you can see, you know, the mountains beyond. And it's just quite a beautiful, beautiful setting. Inside, it sounds, you know, cliche for a writer to say, but oh my gosh, that library. I love that library. It is spectacular. It's beautiful, but it's still at the same time, I think, feels very intimate. And you step in there and you can just imagine yourself, you know, curling up by the fire with a book, and just lovely.
With the designers, you mentioned Frederick Law Olmsted, who other people may know best for his Central Park design.
Absolutely.
One thing that the Biltmore Estate did before there was even any forestry service was practice proper forestry, not just profitability with lumbering, but conservation, which was especially important before, you know, national parks even
became
a thing.
Oh, my gosh. One of the things that I hope people who read take away from this, and one of the things I wanted to give a lot of attention to in this book, was Vanderbilt's and Biltmore Estate's role in United States forestry history. He brought in two foresters during his, you know, early years. The first one was Gifford Pinchot. He would go on to become the first ever chief of the U.S. Forest Service. And the second one was Carl Schenck, who was a German forester who was familiar with the European approach to forestry, which involved maintaining the health of a forest, relying on native species, reestablishing forests that had been damaged while you were simultaneously lumbering. People here weren't that familiar with it at the time because, you know, we just thought, oh, my gosh, this country's so huge, we're never going to run out of trees. So everybody just kept cutting. You know, so Schenck and George, they needed people to work with him. They said, well, let's start a school of forestry. So they start the Biltmore School of Forestry, and that is the very first school of forestry in the United States of America.
In addition to their forestry school, Edith and George, if we fast forward a bit to now when they're married— they also, you know, in kind of contrast to the opulence that this house, you know, projects, they also did a lot for the community surrounding their house and their grounds. So establishing the church, schools, educational programs, hospitals, you know, how important was it to also show their philanthropic measures in addition to this glorious opulence that is
exactly
this house?
Exactly. Because, yeah, on the one hand, you're like, oh, my God, why write about these just exceedingly rich people? But honestly, we are either approaching or we may have actually surpassed the income disparity that existed during the Gilded Age today. But when you look at people like George and Edith, who, I mean, just you named a few things. They started a school for domestic science that, you know, young women could go to learn how to work in fancy rail cars or in nice homes, giving them jobs. They helped get the YMI off the ground, the Young Men's Institute, which became the Center for African-American Culture. In Asheville. They built a hospital. They built the parish school for employees' kids and local kids and sent their own daughter there. They built a church. They helped establish the crafts school and eventual business Biltmore Estate Industries. And all of these things, in addition to, you know, the things you might expect from someone at a high level of society, like, you know, found charter members of the American Red Cross and donating to war efforts during World War I and all that sort of stuff. But there was such an intimacy, especially for Edith, the way that she gave. She wasn't just, you know, writing checks. She would host, the bazaar in the village. She would get on a horse and have a basket with a blanket and food for an employee who was sick or the spouse of an employee who was pregnant. It really endeared them, especially her, to the community. And, you know, honestly, if people with this kind of wealth all behaved that way, the world would be a pretty, pretty okay place,
I
think.
They were very unique in their English estate concept of having a village and a grounds and a self-sustaining operation. This wasn't just, here's my house that I go on vacation to.
Yeah, they really did. There were some hits and misses in the sustaining part for them financially, for sure. But I think also especially deciding to have their daughter Cornelia, she was born in 1900, deciding to have her there instead of going back to their place in New York or going to see her family in Newport. Having Cornelia at Biltmore House, you know, in North Carolina, I think really cemented their relationship with the community.
And also Edith had a big role in cementing their relationship with the community after her husband's death. But you have this interesting arc of how she's viewed by the public, you know, starting from coming from a family who was relatively well-known and respected, but not big money necessarily.
Sure.
And kind of a surprise engagement to most people, or they wouldn't find it suitable. So with her striding between the two worlds of Victorian opulence and then coming down to North Carolina for, you know, so-called country living to what the Vanderbilt estate was, what do you think made her and George such a great pair to do this kind of work together?
That's a great question. In many respects, I think they both sort of walked to the beat of their own drummer in a sense. Edith and her sisters, and her brother as well, but he was a little older, suffered some difficult losses early on in their childhood. I think it made her a rather resilient, wouldn't make everyone that, but I think it made her a rather resilient, independent, strong woman. She was raised by essentially, you know, after her familial losses, she was essentially raised by her governess. So I think she felt a real affection for people who did not have that same kind of New York blood lineage that she did. They were so important to her in her life. And George sort of was happy to be away from the New York scene as well. I think they had travel in common. I think they had philanthropy in common. And I think they each had just enough of a, if not desire, satisfaction and ease at living away from the very claustrophobic world of New York society.
George Vanderbilt kept a books I've read list since he was younger.
I
imagine you saw quite a few of the books he read throughout your research. And I'm curious, did you find any titles that he was strongly enthusiastic about or something that was then turned into your reading list?
Oh, no. No, I didn't. No, I didn't. But I was he had one of the things that I thought was interesting was his collection includes I think he has a first edition of Darwin's book. And he has some really wonderful gems in there, some of which I list in the book. And he had so many books on forestry and botany, and you could really tell that it wasn't just this sort of I'm gonna dabble in this for now. I mean, even if he may not have been totally suited to that particular pursuit, it was clearly something he was very interested in studying, and you can see that in his book collection.
To finish up here, I'm going to read you a quote from your book. So many remnants of that age were already crumbling under the weight of their sumptuous guise, opulence yielding to irrelevance. Biltmore still stands today. It's still owned by the family, but it's welcome to visitors. How has the estate's role changed, and what do you think people should take note of it in today's world?
It's astounding that it is still standing and that it is still essentially in the same setting it was all the way back then. There might be cars driving around or tour buses and restaurants and that sort of thing, but it is a rare opportunity to actually kind of immerse yourself in a very, very different time. It's easy to get distracted by that, not distracted by the house. The house is, you know, one of the main reasons people go there, but I would encourage them to not just look at the extremely gorgeous gardens and fountains and things surrounding the estate itself. But if you go down there, go into the village that once housed people who worked there and the Cathedral of All Souls that George had built for the community. And go a little further afield and go into Pisgah National Forest and look at some waterfalls and enjoy some solitude, because if they had not rejuvenated those forests and protected them, you wouldn't be able to do that. So I always tell people the house is great. The setting is amazing. I'm a huge believer in how significant it is historically. But go a little further afield and see the legacy of what they didn't build.
Well, your book is certainly a good start if they can't make it directly to that location. Denise Kiernan, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.